for coming, and welcome to What is HPV and Why Do I Need to Know? I'm Stacey Nunley. I'm the Director of Gender Matters at the Women's Center. I'm glad to have you all here. This is a topic that's hot in the news. We were just talking about it's everywhere, and I had a conversation with Dr. Green and found out that it's pretty prevalent with student health, so thought we might try to have this conversation. And one of the things we can change about this session today is also have a conversation about how we can get the information out to more people. Whether it's one of the information session, whether it's getting stuff out in the Hustler or other newspaper, like the other communication methods on campus. So I'm going to stop talking because I'm not the expert at all on HPV. And we have a panel of people that have joined us that are our co-sponsors. And I'm just going to take a minute and let you guys introduce yourselves.
Sure. I'm Emmy Kanawati. I'm the Director of Education and Training at Planned Parenthood. In terms of what aspect I can bring to this, I think you all have certainly the lot of bases covered, but I thought I could handle a little bit of sort of the political controversies part of it, because I think the medicine and science you all will take care of.
My name is Beth Huff. I'm a nurse practitioner, and I coordinate the colposcopy clinic. So essentially all I do all day long is deal with women who have HPV-related disease, and they may have genital warts, they may have had an abnormal pap smear, but that's essentially what I do, and I'm in the medical center.
And I'm John Green. I'm a director of student health, and certainly HPV is the most common STD, or probably one of the most common infections that we see at student health. And so often the nurse practitioners or the other physicians will describe a case, or they'll get back an abnormal pap smear. And of course, virtually 25% of all our pap smears are abnormal. And almost all of those are HPV related, whether it be just an atypical or other level. So it's very, very common on any college campus.
Hi, my name's Emma Kofer. I'm an undergraduate here at Vanderbilt, and I'm a member of Fandy Femmes here on campus. I started getting the Gardasil vaccine as soon as I read about it, and I will get my second shot in a week.
Yay,
third
great.
Shot. Third. There we go. I can count.
Great.
Well, I have a couple of questions that I can start out with, and we'll be really informal. So as they talk, if any of you have questions, feel free to jump in. And if you'd introduce yourself before you ask your question, that would be great, too. I guess the biggest, like, first most the pressing question is, what is HPV?
Well, that's certainly the question, you know, that people come to me with, women come to me, and what I generally say is that HPV, which stands for human papillomavirus, and there are other kinds of papillomaviruses in animals. There's equine, bovine, whatever rabbits would be called, rabbit papillomaviruses. But these are the human papillomaviruses, and there are probably over 100 of those. But of those 100, there are about 30, maybe 40 that really like the lower genital tract, and that's in both women and men. So for women, that's the cervix, the vagina, the vulva, the perianal area, and the anus. And in men, that's the scrotum, the penis, the perianal and anal areas in men too. And that group of about 30 or 40 or so, particularly like the lower genital tract. And then you subdivide that group of 30 or 40 into really two separate strains that we refer to as the high-risk strains and the low-risk strains. And in the high-risk strains, those are the DNA types that can cause cervical cancer. But we don't see a whole lot of cervical cancer in this country. But what we mostly see is kind of precancerous abnormalities, so that the cells are beginning to kind of go down toward that cancer pathway, but we fortunately are able to catch it long before it becomes cancer. So those are the high-risk strains of the virus. Then the low-risk DNA strains of the virus cause genital warts. The low-risk strains essentially never cause cervical cancer. The high-risk strains essentially never cause genital warts. So even within that human papilloma virus group, there are two very separate kinds of strains, and that's where I've really had a problem when people refer to it as the wart virus, because warts is just one of the things that I see it do. I'm much more interested in finding those women who have these precancerous abnormalities. So that's kind of where I start with, you know, is letting them know that this HPV stuff is kind of everywhere, and there are lots of different strains. One strain of them, not the these kinds that we're talking about, but some strains can cause plantar warts on the feet. So HPV does a whole lot of different things, but the ones that we're interested in and that we're going to be talking about are that group that like the lower genital tract. How do you respond when you get?
Very similarly, I usually get the question for most young people that I see when they have an atypia on their pap is, what does atypia mean, or what does low grade mean? And so what the pathologist is doing is describing the cells that they're seeing on a pap smear, which is layering out cells from the cervix. So that's basically what a pap smear is. And so atypia would normally mean that the nucleus, it may be a little larger than normal. There may be some changes within the cell that the pathologist is seeing. If it gets past atypia, there may be more than one nuclei in a cell. And so that means that cell has been affected by the virus and is becoming a bit out of control, I guess, is the best way to say how virus affects a cell. And so a young person would come in and say, well, it shows atypia, do I have HPV? Well, in the hospital and in most laboratories, you can actually do a test for the DNA, presence of the DNA of the virus. So with atypias, a lot of times what they do is a reflex test, meaning they reflex check for the presence of the virus. And so most atypias that are read as atypia now do have the virus. Probably 70-80% of low-grade changes will have the virus. And so the next question then is, if I have it, where did I get it? And that's always the next most interesting question. Like Beth said, they have a tendency to be in a certain area. The chances are, if you have it on your cervix, you got it from a person who also has the virus. The most common story I then get is, oh no, my partner's been checked for every infection there is. At that time, you have to say, well, I'm sorry, but there is no specific test for HPV. If you don't, as a male anyway, have a genital wart, then no one can say you're not shedding HPV. And at one time, we did ask most of the men to come in and get checked, and even sent many of them to urology to look very carefully and to do stains, but it's still a very imperfect science, and finding exactly where you were inoculated with the virus or got the virus is not very clear. So my first response is, it's not clear. We don't know the exact epidemiology because you can't track it often in men, because men, if they do come in, they don't have an area you can take a specimen like the cervix. So you can't send that specimen off for the DNA testing. And so that's not a possibility. I can tell that. And in some women, their immune systems are different. It may take a month or two to show up. It may take a year, may take 18 months. And so tracking that down is not an easy task. So we, at Student Health anyway, and I'm sure Beth does too, try to focus on the person and say, how can we get you healthy and make sure that you don't go on to form a precancerous lesion?
One of the things about testing in men, and that's a very good point that Dr. Green brings up, is that, you know, guys will say, well, I went and I got tested for everything, but there is no test that is approved for HPV in men. And I talked to a researcher a few years ago who was looking at trying to maybe develop better ways of testing in men. The virus is a lot easier to recover in women than it is in men. But what they were doing to try to see if they could increase the yield on the test for men was that they would take a sandpaper file and kind of roughen the skin on the penis up a little bit and see if they could recover the virus from that. Well, I'm like, that's not gonna fly. You know, no guy is going to want to do that. So not a lot of volunteers there. But it ends up really being that the main burden of it really does fall on the women. And although there are some abnormalities and possibly some cancers in men, cancers of the penis that may be HPV related, those are so much more rare than the abnormal cell changes that we see in women. So it really ends up being, for the most part, the burden that falls on women. Did you have a question?
You answered.
Oh, okay. All right. Yes.
And just to make sure that I heard you right, there is a test for women? I mean, you can?
Yes.
Just, okay.
Yes, uh-huh. You can do, we can do the test a couple of different ways. One way is that, like Dr. Green said, is that it can be done just out of the Pap test a lot of times. Or if you're doing the kind of the liquid-based Pap test, or you can just do a little brush test that goes into the cervix, similar to having like a chlamydia or gonorrhea test done, and that can be sent to the lab. And what that test will tell you is if you have it, if you have the high-risk form of the virus. We are far more, because we are interested in cancer screening and prevention, we are very interested only in the high-risk forms of the virus, because those are the ones that have the potential to significantly impact your health. We don't, at least in our laboratory, we do not routinely test for the low-risk strains of the virus that cause warts, because even if you had the low-risk wart virus, the chances are very slim that you would end up with genital warts. You may have the virus and never have a wart, and that's probably what usually happens most of the time. So, and just knowing that you had the low-risk form of the virus doesn't help me as a clinician to be able to do anything for you. If you get the warts, then I can do something to treat the warts, but if you don't ever get the warts, don't, you know, I'm not going to worry about it. But knowing that you have the high-risk form of the HPV lets me know what kind of surveillance and follow-up I need to do for you to make sure you don't end up with cervical cancer.
Beth, can I ask you a question, actually? So a person who has had one partner can walk into their provider, or their GYN provider, and ask for a test for HPV?
They can, but the recommendation right now is that because HPV is so common and so prevalent in young women, that we do not recommend HPV testing. As long as your Pap smears are normal, then we say, you know, go on. You may have been exposed, but your immune system seems to be working pretty well right now and keeping this virus at bay, and the virus didn't do anything, so we're fine. So we don't really test them. But the recommendation actually by the American Cancer Society is that at age 30, so you have your Pap smears through your teens and your 20s, and they're all normal, everything's okay, and then you hit age 30 and you say, well, you know what, my Pap smears have always been normal. Do I still have to come every year for a Pap smear? Well, now we can, in women with a history of normal Pap smears, can do a Pap test plus an HPV test. Because again, what we're trying to do is focus on the women at risk for developing these precancerous abnormalities or cancer. So at age 30, we do a Pap test and an HPV test. If your Pap test is negative and your HPV test is negative, you are at the lowest risk level possible. And so you may be able to extend your screening interval out to maybe 3 years, every 3 years, instead of every year with a Pap test. So there are some ways of doing that. Most people generally, again, with good counseling and with people who are sexually active, I think most of us feel a little uncomfortable just testing you. I feel a lot more comfortable testing you for gonorrhea or chlamydia, for an infection that we can treat and identify, than screening you for something that, if your Pap smear is normal, then I'm not too really concerned about that.
Because I just wanted to make sure that that was clear, because a lot of people, that's exactly what happens. They go into a health center and they say, test me for everything. They don't know what that means.
Yeah.
The provider doesn't explain what you're actually being tested for, and you get that clean bill of health and you think you're fine.
Mm-hmm.
That isn't always the case, particularly with HIV, and that's a whole other story. But for the most part, unless your Pap smear is abnormal, has shown something that's atypical, usually most providers won't test for it. In fact, I don't think we do, unless there's something that says to us, let's test for it. So I just want you to know that, because and providers, it's an expensive test from what I understand.
Mm-hmm.
So that all unfortunately goes into decision making.
Mm-hmm. My question was just basically, because I just had my annual Pap smear, and I asked my doctor about the vaccine. That's really where my questions are today. And so she went ahead and tested me for HPV to see if I had it, and if that would then affect whether or not, you know, it would be beneficial to get the vaccine. So that's why
But as you will hear us say up here for the rest of today, is the answer is yes, you should get the vaccine. Because even if you are HPV positive, and I was going to try to even draw this out. Remember I said that there are about 30 or 40 of the types of the low and the high risk types together. The vaccine has two of the high risk types and two of the low risk types. So even if you're HPV positive, that could mean you're positive for one of the DNA types that's not in the vaccine, so that if you ever got exposed to one of those that was in the vaccine, you would have fabulous protection from it. So we really don't recommend testing before we give the vaccine, because by virtue of your age alone, you are eligible for it.
My recommendation to you is, if when you go to a provider, ask them what they're testing for. And if you want something specific, you need to say that. Particularly for HIV. People think that they go to the doctor, they take blood, that means they're getting tested for HIV. And I always tell people, you are not getting tested unless you specifically gave written permission. Hopefully that's changing, I think. But that's my recommendation to you, no matter what provider you go to, because different providers do it differently. We at Planned Parenthood automatically screen for chlamydia and gonorrhea, whether you ask for it or not. Other providers, most of the time, regular providers will just do your pap smear and that's it, unless you specifically ask for an STD screening.
And part of that depends on the prevalence in the population.
Right. Mm-hmm. True.
Because if you look at the student population, and I don't want to make anybody not worry about it, of chlamydia is less than 1%. You go right across the street to the health department, and it's 15 to 16%.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So if you ask, I'll tell you how much it would cost, because again, for students, cost is important.
Mm-hmm.
And if you send those tests to the medical center, they're $115 each. So you just paid $230 for a test that's less than 1%, but it's not that it can't be done.
Right.
And so you try to give the person all the factors that, you know, how common is the disease, how easily is it treated, and how much would it cost for screening. So you have to be pretty specific.
Well, my whole question still is, okay, so if I go to student health and she's telling me, okay, we'll test you for gonorrhea and chlamydia.
Right.
You said something about pap smears. If the pap smear comes back normal, then they don't even bother about HPV. But that's what I'm saying. Is that a pap smear she's doing?
No, that's a totally separate test.
That's why
I think it's a great idea for y'all to learn what's going on down there when somebody's got the speculum in the vagina and looking. So that, you know, that a pap test is one of the things we do. A chlamydia and gonorrhea test, it's a swab, and that's generally done sort of in a together, but it goes into the cervix and that swab goes. So,
we often get students who say, well, I was in the emergency room and they did a pap test.
Yeah, right. They're not doing
what they mean is they had an examination.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so the terminology is kind of vague.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really important that you know exactly what kinds of tests were done, so you know you had a pap plus cultures if appropriate or if you want them to.
I just want to make sure I understand this correctly. If you've had, let's say, one or even two abnormal pap smears and your healthcare provider tells you it's HPV, does that mean they've done the HPV test or they're just assuming?
You need to ask them that, because I will tell you that so many times that the report will read on the pap smear report, it will say low-grade squamous intraepithelial lesion, because we've got low-grade abnormalities and high-grade abnormalities. Yeah. But anyway, but I mean, that tells us something. But then they will say consistent with human papillomavirus infection. Now, the pap smear slide that they read in the lab, there are definitely things in the way the cells look that give us a clue that this is related to HPV, but they can't tell you high risk HPV, low risk HPV, and sometimes those criteria are not always exact. So they're saying there's some cells that make us think that there's HPV here, but that is not the test for it. And I have providers who get that, who think, see that on a report and think that that means that you're tested. the testing for HPV is a completely separate test that is done that says it is either detected or not detected, and that is done on DNA. And that's a DNA test that can be done from the pap smear. If we're doing the liquid pap smear, it can be done from that same liquid that the pap smear is done.
So if
from
they
too.
Tell you high risk or low risk, that means they know for sure.
If they use those terms, absolutely, then they know. And the recommendation really is that although a lot of laboratories will offer the low risk testing, we really recommend that they not even test for it, because it makes, if you're positive for the low risk kinds, you're going to worry so much about, you know, having warts. And every little bump that you get, you'll think, oh my gosh, I've got warts. You know, but
and there's nothing you can do.
And there's nothing, I mean, you're either going to get the warts or you're not. And if you have them, then we certainly want to see you so that we can treat them. But even those women who are positive for the wart strains of the virus end up not getting the warts themselves. So it doesn't help me as a clinician to know how to treat you. It doesn't help you from a mental aspect. And we're really not screening for warts out in the population. We're screening for cancer out in the population.
Yeah, I wasn't, until that commercial that is out now, which I love, that about formula HPV, I didn't know that it goes away most of the time by itself. And if you're tested for it and it's disappeared, is it really gone?
It's a really good question.
That's a fabulous question, one that is debated a lot among experts frequently. You want to...
Well, I think it's pretty split on that. There are some people who think that it's gone completely, because no matter what test you do, you cannot find it, whether it be the swab to look for the DNA, a biopsy, a variety of tests, it's just not detectable. So a lot of experts think that, yes, your body made antibodies to the virus, it drove it out, it's gone. There are others who think that may not be true, that it may be like some other viruses that go dormant, and then during times of either high stress, somebody might be immunosuppressed on a medication, that it could show up again. But again, because there's so many strains, and there are no good tests for exact strains, that is a very difficult question. Now, probably in the future, you'll be able to probably get a blood test to say, yes, you have number 16. That's not commercially available, nor is testing even on the cervix to say exactly which one you have. And so you could have had 16, and then later you could have had 18 or 33. And so it's very difficult to track and to know exactly whether you cleared that strain completely or not.
Yeah, and that's exactly, I mean, as we said, people have gone back and forth about that, but I think the general feeling these days is it probably is in a very low latent phase, and so that we can't find it in any of the tests that we have, and that it very likely, and when you think about how many people have been exposed to and have cleared the virus and how rarely it ever shows up again, you know, so that, you know, we don't see it all of a sudden popping up, you know, 30 years later. It can, but that just doesn't happen most of the time, because most people with good, strong immune systems mount enough of a response to it that it just never shows up again.
What about transmission?
We think that once you have cleared it, that you cannot transmit it, right. But there's still a lot about transmission we don't fully understand. But that's the general feeling.
Speaking of transmission, is there a vaccine for men for the purpose of preventing transmission? Even though it doesn't, you know.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yes.
No, there is not.
Okay.
Not yet. And I feel like within the next couple of years, my guess is they are going to make the vaccine available to men. And I know a lot of people who are actually giving it to men and boys off-label. But I don't recommend that. I like to follow the rules, and I'd like to do what the FDA says is the right thing to do. But I think the reality is we know that, you know, that they are involved in this process also, and that the more people that we can get covered and protected against HPV, the less spread there's going to be. So again, the vaccine hasn't been tested in men because of a lot of the problems with testing guys, like we already mentioned. They couldn't easily be put in the studies because they couldn't be tested easily through that. So that they're having to look at some other kinds of ways, and I think they're looking actually at boys' immune system responses to see if their immune systems respond in the same way that women's immune systems respond to the virus, to the vaccine, and if that response is good, then you can just extrapolate that if it's working in women and they have this kind of immune response, then it will likely work in men too. But that that information is not available yet, and it is not approved for men.
We do.
And how much does that cost?
It's $150 per injection, so $450 total.
Oh, how does that work? It's a series.
It's a series of three.
Okay.
It is. I think the cost from the manufacturer somewhere around $135 or $140. So that's what it costs us to buy it through a wholesaler. So we only add the price of the needle and the routine things we do. So we encourage people to get it.
We did some research, and student health is actually for Vanderbilt students the cheapest place they can go to get that. It's cheaper than local offices.
That's the lowest price I'm aware of.
Including
food. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
What does Planned Parenthood charge?
The series will probably cost somewhere between $600 and $750.
Okay.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And also some insurances will reimburse it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's actually a debate. We were talking about this earlier. I have California Blue Cross Blue Shield insurance, and some insurance companies, including mine, file it as preventative medicine, for which they'll only cover, I think, 70% up to $200, which doesn't really make a dent at all. But actually, one of the great things about our health center is they, on the insurance filing form that they'll give you automatically when you get the vaccine, they file it as a necessary vaccine, which gives you a far larger reimbursement on your insurance form.
And with some insurance companies it works, some are still.
Mm-hmm.
There's no uniformity out there because, and I hate to get into another subject, but insurance companies are out there to make a profit. We think they're just watching out for us. So
I don't think anybody believes that.
Seen those CEO salaries.
And so insurance companies are variable, and if they add something to the policy, they're going to increase the premium many times. So it's a trade-off.
I believe that Vanderbilt faculty, staff, employee, Blue Cross Blue Shield, it is not covered.
Not covered under any of the plans.
But it's my understanding that group of people who decides what kind of things will go into the wellness benefits or those kinds of things have met recently. I have sent an email expressing my support and hope that they would cover this for the Vanderbilt community, that I think it's certainly important. So, you know, I think that it's just going to be a matter, too, of consumers getting out there and calling their insurance company and saying, this is something I want, you know, and that they will hear this enough and that they can respond to those kinds of requests.
Is there a maximum age beyond which you wouldn't recommend that women get the vaccine?
Well, there's a recommended age.
Yeah, the recommended age approved by the FDA is 26.
Okay.
And that's because really what we're talking about, you know, really who we want to get this vaccine and who we really are trying to get it to are young girls before they become sexually active. And so they've really targeted that 11 to 13-year-old age group. You know, that group hopefully is not yet sexually active, although we know that, you know, that there are many that are at by that age. But there are also some other kinds of, that's a good time to catch kids, you know, sort of sports physicals and different things like that, and maybe some hepatitis B, I think, that targeted age group. So that's who is going to benefit the most, are those young girls who have never been exposed to HPV. But the FDA said, we can take it down to as young as 9, and we can take it up to as far as 26. And that's because that's the way the studies looked at those age groups. Now, again, don't you know there are a lot of 28 and 30-year-olds who are calling our offices going, I really want that vaccine. And again, I know that there are some clinicians who have been willing to give that off-label, but what we're talking about here, those women generally, as we get older, generally have begun sexual activity. Again, like we've already said, they may not have ever been exposed to all four of the vaccine types in the vaccine, so yes, they might have some protection from that. But that most of the time, by the time you get to that age, you've been exposed to it and you've cleared it, so you may have already mounted some immune response. Now, the very interesting thing about all this, though, is that the article that just came out this week was that there was a very low prevalence of type 16 and type 18, which are two of the bad guy viruses that cause a lot of the cervical cancers. And those are the two guys that are in the vaccine, so that HPV 16 and 18 are out there, and they probably do some of the worst things to you in terms of these precancerous cells. But there's a lot of HPV that's out there that's not 16 and 18. So even those women who are already positive for HPV, maybe they're not positive for 16 and 18, type 16 and type 18. But again, like Dr. Green said, we don't have a way to test specifically to know which type you've been exposed to. The high risk, we have a panel, and when we say you're HPV positive, that means that one or more of that group of about 13 is positive, but we don't know which ones it is.
Is there any sort of protection afforded after, say, the first and or second vaccine, or is it only once you've completed the series?
There is some protection after the first one. I hate to advertise that too vigorously, but because really completing the series is extremely important, and it's the only, because that's the way the studies were set up, that's the best information we have to know that. But it does appear that there is certainly an immune response that you get after that first one. But
it's a little like hepatitis B. Some
yeah,
people are protected definitely almost fully after two, but in order to get into that 90th percentile of protection,
yeah,
you need a third one as well. So you probably do make antibodies, and depending on your immune system, you may or may not have some protection.
Yeah.
So it's because we all have different immune systems. Some people apparently never get the flu, never get a cold. Some people get every virus that comes around. So we're all wired just a little differently in terms of our ability to fight viruses.
What is the vaccine? I mean, is it a live virus or is it a dead virus? I mean, what does it do in order to?
Yeah, it's not a live virus. It's something called a VLP, a virus-like particle.
Just a little piece of a particle. It's not even a kill.
Yeah, it's kind of like a shell. It's that's tricking your body into thinking that it's the real HPV DNA, but there is no DNA, so it's not infectious. Won't give you HPV. Won't make you test positive for HPV if you've gotten it. And if you're around immunosuppressed people in your environment, you can't pass anything on to them. So it's non-infectious that way.
Just to follow up on the other question. So if your body starts producing the antibodies after the first one, and let's say you've already tested positive, can that help clear the HPV that already exists?
Great question, and boy, don't we wish that it did, but no, we don't think that it does. We don't think that it boosts your immune response anymore. If you've already developed some immune response to that particular vaccine type, then we don't think it boosts it anymore. But that's what we hope so much for in the future, that for women who already have these abnormalities, have HPV and maybe have the precancerous cells or have the warts, is there some kind of something that we can give them? And that's where what we're learning about this preventive vaccine, because that's what we're really going for here. We hope that we will learn some things from it that might help us to develop a therapeutic vaccine.
I think the antibodies are fairly type specific.
Okay.
And so that's one of the things with, again, tracking down the exact type, because a person, as I said earlier, appears to have cleared it, and then they may have an atypical pap or show the DNA later, and we don't know exactly whether that is a latent virus that's showing back up, mm-hmm. or were they reinfected. Mm-hmm. And so we, since we can't.
If it's a different number, would they just assume it would be reinfected?
But see, there's a whole, as Beth said, there's a long list of high-risk types. And so you can't even break those down very much in terms of testing. It's just, they just group them. When the pathologist reports or the lab reports, say low-risk types, and we, like the medical center, don't even test for low-risk types because it's expensive mm-hmm. and it's not going to tell you very much. You get occasional student that says, I want to know. Mm-hmm. I say, well, okay, if you got the extra money to pay, but it's not going to make us do anything differently, I'm still going to ask you not to smoke. I'm still going to ask you to take a daily vitamin, take good care of yourself, exercise, reduce your exposures, and use condoms. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to give you the same line of things to take care of yourself, whether you're positive or not. So if you just...
For the low risk.
For the low risk. Well, and the same things to do for the high risk.
Yeah.
But you'd also want to do more follow-up screening.
Absolutely.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
But I think that what he said, too, about, you know, keeping your immune system strong, and that's, you know, when I see students, you know, I mean, you know, and you say, you know, well, you need to, you know, low stress. Well, ha, ha, you know, I mean,
get plenty of rest.
Get plenty of rest, right. You know, it's just not going to happen when you're in this phase of your life in general. And so you've, you know, you're stressed out over school and have all these things due, and then you catch a cold and you do that, and then you happen to go by and you need, you know, you're going to get on birth control pills or something, and you go and you have your pap test done. Well, your immune system is so low at that point. Yeah, you know what? That may be just the time that it's going to show up on your pap smear. So keeping your body's immune system strong, and I think one of the most important ones in that list is not smoking. Because interestingly enough, nicotine, for all of the other things that it does to your body, heart, lung, and blood vessels that we know, but nicotine, interestingly, goes to your cervix. It likes the cervix. It goes to that cervical mucus, and it forms sort of a little, what we think happens is that it keeps the cells at the cervix from exerting their own immunocompetent effect. So it makes the cells on the cervix a little immunosuppressed and a little bit more susceptible to things in its environment. So
this just blew my mind.
Yeah, blew your mind. Well, I know.
Well, who knew? And it makes some sense because the columnar cells on the cervix are very similar to those in the lung.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so carcinogens are concentrated in the mucus-producing cells. And we tend not to associate those two parts of our bodies, but it's putting both those areas at risk by smoking.
I never think about any other body part except the lower genitals. I'm afraid that's I'm sort of have a single-minded focus that way. But that's an excellent point. That's
just
exactly
when you think
right.
smoking can't get any more dangerous.
Exactly.
Concentrated in a very concentrated place, actually, right in that area where those cells that are mucus producing. Mm-hmm. So it's a dangerous thing to do.
What are the side effects of the vaccine? Are there any?
I didn't have.
You know, I think it's mostly what basic vaccines are, sore arm, maybe a little draggy for a day or two, maybe a little low-grade fever, you know, or a little stomach upset. But again, most people tolerate most other vaccines well, and this one seems to be well tolerated too.
Yeah, one of the commentaries said fainting, but I faint when you give me any kind of shot. So I think that someone who was against the vaccine said, well, 36 girls fainted. And I said, well, I do too. Bring me around me, I'll faint. So if that's a side effect of a shot, but I don't think it's that vaccine. I think it's a needle going through your skin.
Mm-hmm. You have a question?
Some people don't tolerate that.
No, sorry.
Yeah. I was just wondering, one of the things that's sort of caused confusion, like when I've just talked to my friends about this, is in all the media about it, there's this, it's recommended strongly for women before they're sexually active. And I don't think it's meant to, but it gives the impression that if you are sexually active, it's not going to do you any good. So what's behind saying that exactly?
Well, you want to talk about that and give some of those?
I actually think you answered it before, because it's about prevention. And so if you prevent things before people are exposed to them. So it's about, let's get people before they're most likely exposed. And so you're right, the intent is more about let's really make this preventive as opposed to possibly after the fact, which might make it less effective. And I think that's really what's more than anything behind
and,
it.
And
those are the studies.
And the other point, too, is that people ask about this, well, if I am HPV positive and I get the vaccine, will it be harmful to me in some way? And it does not seem to be. Just, you know, you're just not going to get the benefit from it. But I can't look at you or see a patient and tell her, in you, the vaccine is going to be X percent effective. You know, if you have never been sexually active and never had any sexual assault or had any sexual exposure to HPV, then I can tell you pretty much that the studies say it's 100, essentially 100% effective, you know, high 90s or 100%. But if you have been sexually active, and for you, I can't tell you how effective the vaccine will be. But my guess is it will provide you some degree of protection. I just can't tell you how much.
So you would recommend it?
I recommend it, absolutely. I mean, as I say, I mean, all I see all day long are women who already have HPV, right. And I recommend it for all of my patients that are below age 26, because I think they... But let me tell you, the hardest group of people I have the hardest group or knowing exactly what to say to them are women who come to me and they're about to get married. And of course, you know, that hopefully is going to be their last sexual partner they will ever have. And so they say, well, should I get the vaccine? Well, my feeling is, you know, I know what rates of divorce are, and I know that, you know, we're in a war right now where young men go off and are killed and people may have, you know, sexual assault. You know, that there may be another sexual partner that woman may have in the future, or her partner may have one. But when somebody is in love and they're about to get married, you know, you sort of hate to bring up all of the bummer things of life. But I do.
Her partner could be infected and not know. Right.
Mm-hmm.
There's
exactly.
No way for him to know.
Mm-hmm.
It, right?
Mm-hmm.
So for that reason, the vaccine would still be a good idea.
So I do recommend it for all women. But I would like maybe, Emmy, for you to talk about some of the political and some of the things that we've seen a lot in the media about,
right.
You know, about parental response to
right.
this.
Well, I think there's been a lot of anecdotal stuff in terms of how parents are reacting. Some parents are all gung-ho about it and have absolutely no issue because they do see it as cancer prevention. And unfortunately, like anything in our society, anything related to sex will always take on a lot of controversy, particularly when it has to do with youth. So, you know, there's proposals in, I think, 18 states on making this mandatory, but I think in every single state there, and I believe this is the case for general immunizations, you might be able to speak more to this, parents have the option to opt out.
Mm-hmm.
And we do support that, but because we believe that the health benefits are so huge that we do support mandatory vaccination for all girls at the moment, and hopefully boys too.
Are parents coming to Planned Parenthood with young children, like 9 to 13?
We haven't gotten a lot of response at the moment. I think in part because really right now, two big obstacles lie in our way. A is the cost, and we recommend it to be mandatory only if enough resources are available so that people can actually access it. So it doesn't become a health disparity issue, you know, for people in terms of socioeconomic status. So that's one issue. The other problem we have right now, because it's so expensive for us, we can't stock it.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes, you know, okay, you want this, you have to pay for it ahead of time, we will order it, we will have you come in again, and then you get the injection. So it's, unfortunately, we're not the best place right now, unless we're your only option, and then, you know, absolutely come to us. So those are some of the issues. But we've gotten people asking for it. You have to have parental consent in order to have it, so that if people do come in, they actually do have to come in with their parent, or a parent will most likely bring a young girl in.
And the one great thing is that the vaccine is now being covered under the Vaccines for Children program, which is a federal program, which, you know, when you go to the health department and you get your, you know, polio
MMR.
And your MMR and all of those other things, those are vaccines that are covered under the federal government to make sure that there are no disparities, that all children are covered for those kinds of diseases that we do have vaccines for. And the HPV vaccine is now one that is being covered mm-hmm. under the Vaccines for Children program, which means that the health departments, I'm not sure if they've got it in yet, but it will certainly be available for under age 18, I believe that yeah. is, that you would be eligible for that. So
would a pediatrician administer that?
Well, yes, you certainly can, but the pediatricians are a little freaked out about this too, because they're struggling with the same issues again, because their general patient population, for the most part, are young children, and they're not talking a lot about these sexual issues, and I think it's making them a little bit uncomfortable too, and trying to think about, you know, talking to parents about this and bringing it up. And then the OBGYNs, who talk about sex a lot more, but they've never done a vaccination program. They're not at all used to doing vaccines. Like, the pediatricians know how to give vaccines, and they've got the whole program all set up. So all of us in different areas are sort of having to learn new pieces and parts of how to incorporate this into our practices.
I mean, would you bring like a 12-year-old girl to a gynecologist for this?
Could.
If that
I mean,
was the option.
Could be going
yeah,
to a gynecologist.
I, you know, certainly discuss it with their primary care doctor, and if they were not interested in the mother's gynecologist or big sister's was, and the family wanted it, I don't think there's any set rule about who can give it. It's
and you don't,
any
and
nurse
you
can administer
it. Yeah, and you don't have to have a pelvic exam,
yeah.
right.
see, to do it.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
well,
it would just be...
A lot of private practitioners may not stock it, so you
mm-hmm.
may have to call around to find
mm-hmm.
or call ahead.
But you could go to the health department soon.
I think, yes, I don't, do you know if they have it yet?
I don't know for sure.
I'm not sure that they do yet, but I know that they will be at some point. And you know, sort of what their criteria are, it's for uninsured, underinsured, they have certain criteria for that Vaccines for Children's program. But my question on that is that I don't have the answer to is underinsured mean that you do have insurance, but insurance that won't pay for preventive vaccines, and that may qualify under their underinsured criteria.
Can you mention people who are against the vaccine? Can you just touch on why? Because everything that I've seen about it sounds absolutely wonderful, but most of what I've seen about it is paid for by the drug company. So I'm just wondering, because it is so expensive, and I just want to know all viewpoints. So can you kind of touch on why people are opposing it, aside from it deals with sexuality and young girls?
Well, that's the
that's
big issue, actually. That really is what it is. It's confronting the fact that young people at some point will be sexually active, which is 90% of the population. Most people are not virgins when they get to marriage, if they actually get married. So it's really making us confront, you know, a big issue in terms of youth and sexuality. People believe it'll make it, that it becomes a permission to have sex, which is the same argument given about condoms, which is the same argument given about sex education, which has been completely rebuffed by research, that education and prevention do not cause people to become more sexually active. I mean, people aren't thinking to themselves, oh, great, I got this vaccine. I don't have to worry about HPV. I'm going to have a whole bunch of unprotected sex. Or now that I have this, I'm going to have unprotected sex. That's not what happens. It's one of those things that sometimes conventional, not always being correct, wisdom kind of says to us, but it's just not backed up by research.
I remember back in 87, a student asked me if she could have sex. So they do it all the time.
Yeah.
Once every 20 years,
yeah.
a student says that. Okay.
So well, the interesting thing
I suspect
that
if I live long enough in, what, 2027,
yeah, yeah.
another
one
student
more.
Yeah. And I wonder, too, about what are the, you know, because, again, once again, I feel the onus has fallen on women, even though, obviously, the most devastating effects are on women. It's the second most common killer cancer diagnosis in women worldwide.
Yeah.
Fortunately, we are very fortunate in this country that cervical cancer isn't that big a problem here.
Because of screening.
Mm-hmm. Because we have access to health care. In other countries, women do not have the same access. They die from it with 200,000.
Yeah,
it's
ridiculous.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
So we are tremendously lucky, and unfortunately, from what I understand, the vaccine strains, the strains that are most common in this country are not the most common strains internationally. So the vaccine that we have won't even apply to women internationally. Mm-hmm. So thinking about that too. So I just want to say one more thing. Yeah. Sorry. I forgot. That's okay. Go ahead.
But the health effects from the vaccine and the fact that this is a new drug and it seems like, you know, a lot of people are just jumping on board with it. I mean, there's no inherent health risks in doing it. It's just an issue really of how expensive it is.
Plus, if you tell any American something is mandatory,
yeah.
at least 50%
yeah.
of them are going to react.
Yeah.
Because we just don't like to be told
what
this is
be doing.
What is mandatory.
I remember the point I was going to make. You know, what happens when we come up with an HIV vaccine? You know, the fact that because HPV has, or cervical cancer is really a problem for women, but HIV is a problem for everybody. You know, so are we going to make the same argument about, oh, well, if we come up with an HIV vaccine, then people are going to go and have a bunch of unprotected sex. Well, guess what? People are having a bunch of unprotected sex now and we don't have anything. So let's get people protected. Let's not punish them for something that's a very human behavior. So.
Emma, I had a question, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but for you, like, what made you decide to get the vaccine, and then how did you do it? How easy was it to navigate to find out about it?
Well, actually, I heard about the vaccine right when it came out and right when it came into the press because, actually, my mom sent me the newspaper clipping with little, like, scribble at the bottom, get this now. So, I mean, I'm very lucky to have, a family that, you know, supports safety and health above, like, moral judgment and such things. And it was just a preventative thing that she wanted me to do. And it was the easiest thing in the world. I just called the health center, said I wanted the vaccine. They set me up with the first one. Actually, I was so early in the program that they didn't have the insurance sheet set up. So when I got my second shot, I had to get one for the first one as well. But it's so easy. You just go in, and I think it's like every 3 months or so you get another shot. Or it differs between the first and second and third.
Yes, it's
sure.
0, 2 months later,
yeah.
and then six mm-hmm. months after the first
six
one.
Months.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So... it was the easiest thing in the world. The shot takes 5 seconds, and they literally, at our health center at least, give you a piece of paper with all of the tax filing and insurance information already filled out. All you need to do is write your name on it and send it to your insurance company. It could not be easier.
Yay.
Yeah.
Well, we actually participated in one of the clinical trials, so we have a relationship with the company. So some Vanderbilt students actually were in the trial to see. They got either placebo or the vaccine. That study's over now, but it was, I think, 2002 to 2005 or 2006.
Mm-hmm. So. Going back to her question, I've heard the argument that this vaccine will, you know, encourage people to, you know, skip their annual or their yearly pap smear or whatever. Are you concerned about that? Or?
Well, you know, we are concerned about that, and I try to make that point, you know, when I am counseling someone about it, is that this does not take place for regular screening because we know that there are, you know, at least 15 or 20 of those high-risk types out there, and the vaccine only has 2 of them in there. So that means there's a whole slew of them you could still be exposed to that have nothing to do with the vaccine and that could still cause some of these abnormal cells. So that screening is still, that's why this country hardly has such a low rate of cervical cancer, is because we have done such a good job of screening. But there are pockets within the country that have much higher rates of cervical cancer. And Appalachia is one over in East Tennessee. In certain areas, you know, and you just think about because we just can't reach those women. My feeling is that we are far more likely to be able to reach them with public health initiatives like vaccination programs than we are going to be able to with pap smear screening programs. So I'm hopeful that, you know, the rate of cancer, cervical cancer in this country really fell and became very low. But we've kind of plateaued out here for a number of years. And where I see us maybe being able to make, to really get that little plateau down now is through the use of the vaccine. And it's going to take 20 plus years before we start seeing the real effects of vaccine given now to young girls, because cervical cancer really doesn't happen until you're in your kind of 40s and 50s. So there's about a 20 year lag time. So it's going to take us a while for us to start seeing the true benefits of it. But I think that that's how we can get out and reach women, not only in our country, but also the Bill Gates Foundation is very interested in looking at vaccine for around the world. And so we can reach women that cannot get traditional screening.
Are they looking at vaccine for the other types? Is that in development? And why did they pick these two?
Well, these two are the worst guys. These two cause 70% of all cervical cancers. This type 16 and type 18. When you put them to, and type 16 probably more than 18, but those two guys together seem to be kind of the bad actors. And then type 6 and 11, which are the two low-risk types, cause about 90% of all genital warts. So,
which the vaccine also works against.
Mm-hmm, right? Yeah, the vaccine is 16 and 18 from the high-risk strains and 6 and 11 from the low-risk strains. So it's a quadrivalent vaccine, which means four types. So those four types. So, I think at some point they will really be expanding that on, especially once they start seeing how this goes. The second vaccine is coming, it probably will be approved this year, but it's only the two high-risk strains. And I don't know, and so people have said, well, you know, why would I get that company's vaccine if I can get this one that's out now against four strains? And I think we'll just have to wait and see, you know, will it be a significantly cheaper and therefore more. And if we're really trying to decrease cervical cancer, you know, should we just focus on that? Will it do any number of things, you know, that maybe this other one doesn't? So I think we just have to wait and see when it gets approved what comes out about that. But it may have some other benefits that we're not aware of over what we've got, what has been approved.
Which company's producing that?
Which what?
Which company?
That's GSK, GlaxoSmithKline.
What's that vaccine?
Cervarix, Cervarix.
You mentioned something about different strains being more prominent in other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the high risk strains or the low risk? And is anybody working on that? Do we know?
I'm not as familiar. Literally,
right.
What I know is that they are. It's like HIV. It's the same thing.
Right.
There are different strains that are present in different parts of the world, and everybody's different.
Right.
Research is concentrating on the different parts. I would venture to say that it might have something to do with money. People in this country are more likely to be able to pay for it than in other countries.
Sure.
Unfortunately.
Have we hit kind of the big
main
ones? I think
most of them.
And this has been the news lately, and I think we've mentioned it, but just again, how common is HPV? And maybe even from each of your perspectives, like the population that you deal with, how common do you see HPV?
Well, since that's all I do, 100% of my patients have HPV. So I have a very skewed, and when I go out and talk to people about this, I'm definitely skewed on this because it is the complete part of my particular practice. So that's why I am so particularly delighted that we've got something coming out about this. But, you know, the statistics that are out there and this new paper that just came out this week talks a little bit about, you know, that it's that in the about 50% of the 20 to 24 year old age group, I believe, about 50% of those today, if you tested every 20 to 24 year old woman in the country today, the prevalence data says that almost 50% are HPV positive today. Now, see, that doesn't count the ones that have cleared the virus.
Right.
I mean, so that's That's a lot of people. You know, that's the sexually active population. And there are also some things about young women, too. There's something about the way your cervix is made that makes the cervix kind of more susceptible to HPV when you're younger than when you get older. So that's probably another reason why we tend to see more HPV in a younger age group. There, you know, you're probably having more sexual partners. Your cervix is a little bit more vulnerable when you're younger. A couple of different things.
And there's a race component as well. I was actually just reading some research about the fact that even though in general African American youth tend to have less partners over a lifetime, they're actually more likely to get a sexually transmitted infection. Mm-hmm. And this data in the Tennessean that Linda just gave me this morning, this article, shows that in terms of HPV as well, that I guess both black men and women, or maybe this is just women, have a higher percentage of HPV infections.
This is in today's paper?
Yeah,
oh, okay.
And not necessarily because they're having more sex, just that they're more likely. And again, you can think about access to healthcare and quality of healthcare, et cetera. So.
And, oh, sorry, just in terms of applicability to Vanderbilt mm-hmm. students, my perception of it, I mean, just reading all the articles that my mother continued to send me.
I love your mom.
She's cool. My perception of it is you can't be more high risk than like a young female college student in the like a sexually active campus/environment. I mean, we're the people who are going to get HPV and we're the people who are going to like eventually develop cervical cancer. So it just almost seems kind of silly not to get it, just because if we are the highest risk group and we can prevent it, I mean, it might be expensive, but hey, you can charge it to your student account, first of all. Second of all, insurance is going to cover part of it. And third of all, it's a lot cheaper to get a vaccine than to get cervical cancer. So almost every single one of my friends that I've talked to about this, and I have specifically talked to a lot of my good friends, all of them are getting it. And all of them have talked their parents into it. And it's just it just seems necessary.
For Emma, how long did it take you to get reimbursed by your insurance?
I actually just sent off the paperwork a couple days ago because I had to like track down a code because California is horrible. So anyway, yeah.
And then just to hit on a little bit more about in terms of prevalence, because I don't work at our health center, I couldn't tell you what the prevalence in our population is, but one of the things that we fight against in terms of education is this whole issue of condoms. And when we do talk about, you know, when you come up against people who are doing abstinence-only education, which
the
you know,
is
right, the problem, I mean, the many problems that there are with it is that people are less likely, even if they do abstain for longer, when they do become sexually active, and we know that most people do at some point in their lives, they're less likely to use any form of contraception, including condoms. So that actually puts them, in essence, that puts them more at risk mm-hmm. if that's the only kind of sex education that they've actually received. So in talking, when we talk about HPV and STI prevention, we always talk about, you know, abstinence is the only 100% method if you use it 100% of the time and if you use it correctly. And if not, condoms are the best protection. They're the only protection we have right now. And they're not perfect, and that doesn't mean because you use one that you're not going to get it, but what would you rather take, an 85% chance or a 3% chance if you use it correctly, you know? So those are the kinds of things that we deal with in terms of education around this issue.
The Tennessean had an article a couple weeks ago that basically said that nobody's getting it.
I saw that.
Getting back.
I think that there, you know, I mean, again, I think probably that's probably a little bit true. I think some states have been a little bit more proactive and have done some things that have gotten it out there a little bit more. We're just a little bit slower. But you know, I mean, this is a whole new sea change and a whole new thing, and hadn't even been a year yet that it's been approved. And I think, you know, I mean, through forums like this, through, you know, education, getting stuff out in your student newspaper and things like that, I mean, I think that that's all of our responsibility to do is to talk about it and to get the word out there, because it is pretty well demonstrated that as soon as you, oftentimes that you, if you take a group of people who say, no, I don't want that vaccine, but then you give them some education about it, then a significant number of them change their mind. And you know, I mean, that's what education does. You know, it arms you with knowledge to make those kinds of decisions for yourself. So I think we just need to make sure that we're doing that. I will say a lot of the patients that I see have TennCare, and TennCare is paying for it, which is, you know, pretty amazing. So that's been very good for our patient population.
Do you know off the top of your head, if you don't explain, if Champus TRICARE covers it?
That one I don't know off the top of my head.
Mm-mm. As Emma said, it's very prevalent on campus.
Yeah.
It's the number one STD or sexually transmitted infection on our campus. Happens to be a virus. Number two is a virus, HSV or herpes. And so the bacterials that are easily treated by antibiotics are further down the list. So if you think it's not out there, it's a misperception. It is clearly on this campus, very common.
Unlike what I heard about Vanderbilt is everybody gets a Z-Pack, so nobody has chlamydia or gonorrhea.
Well, that's an interesting theory, and it would be an interesting study to do, actually.
Right, yeah.
Because most people, for their sinusitis, want a Z-Pack.
Right.
And azithromycin does treat gonorrhea and chlamydia,
right,
to some degree, primarily chlamydia. But if you give out that many Z-Packs, you may be altering the incidence or the prevalence.
Yeah, and the joke that we made in the class was, but don't go to Belmont, because they don't have it.
The last thing I'd love to do before we go is for you to give us advice on how we can get this out. Like, should we have more of these sessions? And you guys, if you have ideas too, I mean, should we flyer the campus? Should we...
My primary suggestion, and I hope I don't step on any toes here, I think the only person I could offend is like Taylor and myself. I really think we need to do outreach to the sororities. We had an educational session in our sorority to talk about HPV, and just because it's like groups of girls in a college environment, and I mean that should be the target audience for getting people this vaccine on our campus. So I don't know if perhaps Vandy Femmes or the Women's Center or Planned Parenthood or someone could offer to come in and speak to individual sororities as an educational session, because sororities have to meet an educational requirement anyway, or perhaps even one of these events could be done in a larger venue and perhaps a little more formalized, and all sorority members could come as a sort of info session.
Is there like a Greek...
There's a
council
program.
Where all the sororities and fraternities
meet. There's the offices upstairs. It's pandemic.
So I was going to say, if they have a meeting, you know, certainly I absolutely offer this. We can come and talk about,
Kristen,
hey,
Tori,
you can do this.
I have a meeting with Kristen tomorrow, so I will bring that up to her.
Cool.
And then I'd love the Baby Femmes and Planned Parenthood. Maybe we could, between all of us, we could hit all the sororities.
Or even if,
and use
like,
podcast.
Taylor and I could go and, like, hand out flyers at people's chapter meetings.
Well, I forgot to introduce myself before my question.
Oh, sorry.
Actually,
and I just realized, were you not able to get any information from the Merck rep?
No, she was great. Susan Murphy was great. She just couldn't be here today.
Okay.
And she ordered materials for me, but they were back ordered.
Okay.
So
yeah. Everybody's getting them now.
The Women's Center,
okay.
And be able to distribute those kind of pamphlets.
Yeah.
She was actually really helpful.
Good. They have some really cute brochures. It starts off saying something. Would you tell her she had lipstick on her teeth? You know, or something like that. And it's essentially, you know, would you tell her about HPV? You know,
right.
Sort of a friend kind of a thing. You know,
someone.
You know, to tell someone exactly is that in that whole.
I think the residence halls, they do educational programming all the time. That would be a good place to do it. And the women's faculty.
That's a good idea.
Women's faculty are in every department across campus. We could ask them if they would be willing to do it.
We would.
I'd like to ask them. I would. I mean, I'm going to do it in my class, but I'd like for the men to do it too.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think women's faculty will probably, a high percentage would be receptive to taking 5-10 minutes to hand out some flyers and answers.
You have to give extra credit.
Actually, I did offer credit for people to come to the session, but I'm the only
Well, my suggestion, I put it on here, but as in regards to that, I know just within the Vandy Femmes, this was just a bad time with class and everything like that.
And
so maybe evening, early evening, something like that.
have
especially if you did a group programming for
mm-hmm.
like sorority members,
yes.
it would have to be in the
80s.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Gotcha. But we do all appreciate your taking time out of the middle of the day.
Yeah.
Thanks to you.
Absolutely. It's our pleasure. My pleasure.
Certainly not.
Yeah.